2012. Just can't get enough.
Gerard wasn't listening, which Frank had gotten sort of used to in the last couple of years. This was kind of new, though, because Frank had assumed when they were living together he'd get a little more of Gerard's attention, just by virtue of being around more. It was a pretty brilliant solution to Frank's constant need for Gerard to pay attention to him, in Frank's humble opinion. It was also a pretty brilliant solution to how freaking expensive campus housing was. But Frank didn't like to bring that up, because Bob always gave him the look. Then Frank would get all snippy and point out not all of them had the luxury of picking up their TAs and living with old people who were probably on social security, and Bob would hit him and say Brian was only, like, 25, and Gerard would have to separate them before there was a repeat of the Great War of sophomore year. The Great War, which Frank had won, by the way. Fuck you very much.
...2013. Accidentally in love. Rudy cocked his head. "Why do you have a clone in your room, Mike?" he asked mildly. It only inflamed Chip, of course. That was probably why he'd done it, Mike supposed. He kept darting longing looks at the door, but Rudy was firmly planted and Chip seemed unwilling to confront him. "How have you been, Chip?" said Rudy. Chip howled. "Miller, what are you doing here?" "Well, Mike lives here," he said, "so I'm here quite a lot." He shot an unreadable look at Mike, who was trying to restrain his hysterical urge to laugh, mostly unsuccessfully. "I think the question is, what are you doing here?" "He's a dance instructor," Mike choked out. "He's studying at the NBS." "Really?" Rudy's eyes lit up. "Oh, Chip, you have cheered me up in my hour of need."
2014. God, you two are so married.
"What's your song?" Cody asks, when they're shooting up for practice and Tyler is getting his earbuds in.
What?
Tyler asks, and looks down at his phone. He gestures with his earbud.
"Like, on here?"
"No," Cody says, and flicks his hand between Tyler and Jamie.
"Like, for your first dance?" Tyler almost drops his earbuds. He looks around, wondering if he missed the first part of the joke. No one is looking at them expectantly. In fact, no one is really paying attention to them at all. Tyler can't think of anything he or Jamie may have done to prompt it anyway. Cody looks so serious, and Tyler has no idea what is going on. Thankfully, Jamie sits up then, reaching out to tap his knuckles on Tyler's thigh. "We're not gonna have one, Eeks. Too awkward." Cody looks insulted, like not having a first dance at their joke wedding is the worst thing he's ever heard of. "You have to," he says, and Jamie shakes his head.
2015. The one with the bros. Stiles figured it was about time he took a serious look at his life choices. Douchebag witches were trying to suck the life out of his friends. More douchebag witches were chasing him through the preserve to stop him from stopping that happening. It was only Monday, and he had work in the morning. And these witches weren't just douchebags like his phone was a douchebag when it froze up and he had to pull the battery. They were actual douchebags. They were frat boys from UCLA. Styles had heard their two lookouts seriously debating beer pong versus flip cup right before they saw him sneaking through the woods, and one of them was wearing a UCLA tank top in November. Styles had never seen a wild great American bro this far north in California. It was a little exciting when he took a step back from the fact that they were trying to kill Scott and Derek for power. But as exciting as douchebags in the wild were, there he was, poor life choices and all, running through the preserve with two hulking bros tearing after him down an overgrown path. They were strong and had too many muscles for what they probably used them for, keg stands and Facebook during class, but he knew these woods and he knew how to run from a fight. Shrapnel. As far as the aphorism, I think the thought is what counts when you send a well-meaning gift that a recipient ends up hating, or when a traffic accident causes you to miss your dinner reservation, or when she's severely allergic to flowers and to chocolate. I don't believe that the excellent intentions of our thought will hold much sway against botching a reconnaissance mission that took months to plan. The lieutenant's gonna kill us. Ed translates. No, Roy says. A quick death is better than we deserve. Torture, I think. Maiming, perhaps. She hasn't maimed anyone in a long while. She's probably eager for a proper mauling. She wouldn't really... Not Lieutenant Hawkeye. Stupid Mustang's totally just fucking around. Right? You're full of shit. Ed says. Frequently, Roy says. They have taken photographs of our footprints in the dust. It was not the fall of the temple that broke his faith. Chirrut survived, and thus he did too. And Baze would suffer through 100 lifetimes for that. He had always known that his faith was but a pale reflection of Chirrut's, which filled him like a fresh water spring, clean and cool and ever refilling. Baze's was a finite resource, and once it was mined, there was nothing left but an empty hollow. It was several years since the stormtroopers entered the temple, exiling them into the city with no purpose other than Chirrut's burning belief in the Force. They still lived, Baze taking any job that paid well, and Chirrut doing what he did best, which was to cause trouble from which he must be saved. I want you, really, I mean really. The sign looms over Sukjin. Well, okay, it doesn't loom, because it's not the kind of sign that looms. For that matter, nor is sweet peas. It's an adorable woodwork thing with actual sweet peas twining around it. Absolutely worth the ankle Jungkook bro to get them up there, but no one heard that from Sukjin. It's actually quite minimalistic. A matte black rectangle with barely visible letters reading After Hours, which light up blue at night. Sukjin knows. He's been there. At night. To see. Sukjin hates this man. There's no doubt about it. He gave it a week. Actually, to be completely fair and totally not biased in the direction of Sukjin's one-inch temper, he's given it all of the 4 months it took to renovate the once-upon-a-time second-hand digital store into the men-in-black monstrosity it is now. He gave it a week since the opening of this... thing. But he very definitely hates this man. 2018. The Mirror Wheel Eye. He turned and ran for the abandoned section of the market district, barely remembering to circle back in case of pursuit. It didn't matter. Kakashi wasn't home. Iruka stared stupidly at the door. Kakashi was supposed to be his partner in this. The one who told him, "You can do exactly this and be safe." The one who knew where to find him if it all went wrong. He heard Genma's voice in his head. "You're an asset, Iruka." But Iruka didn't really believe that. Kakashi was on a mission, or practicing his chakra control someplace, like Iruka had told him to. He couldn't wait. Root could build whatever jutsu and tricks they wanted right into the mortar. Iruka had stopped them, had fixed it, and they were just starting all over again because Kakashi was right. Root and Anbu were two brawling giants. An ant, like Iruka, only existed to get crushed between them. The typical love song. Johnny arches a finely shaped eyebrow, thanks Nunas, and looks Taeyong up and down. His gaze is slow and borderline possessive, starting at the exposed skin of Taeyong's thighs and trailing up to his collarbones, where the big sweater slides off his left shoulder. "Devour me," Taeyong's brain sings. "Eat me alive." Johnny asks slowly, purposefully, and without tease, "Is that my sweater?" Taeyong's tongue is sticking to the backs of his teeth, and his palms feel sweaty. Johnny's gaze is hot. He's probably mad, but even so, it's attractive. "Sorry." Taeyong shifts. "I didn't think it'd be a big deal." "You have no idea."